Now, I know that we're a little bit short-staffed tonight because apparently this Shear is in competition with a number of Lag BaOmer hilulas, they might call it, or parties that are going on right now. It sounds Hawaiian when you call it a hilula, even though it's not exactly what's going on, I know. But I bring that up to thank you for your dedication to Talmud Torah and to keeping the consistency, even though all the fun dancing and partying and COVID spreading going on, you're here right now learning Torah with all of us. So that's a very beautiful thing. Okay. I probably will go to one of these outdoor parties. I think Rabbi Kamen might be having something for men that I might drop by. So don't worry, I'm not that much of a buzzkill, killjoy. So let's go forward. We are actually on Yud Amud Aleph on 10A. So this is it's really the ninth page because we started on Beis Amud Aleph. But, you know, if it makes us feel good, this is 10A. So that's a real milestone right over there. We've been making a lot of progress all of these weeks. So it should feel really good that, at least if you're looking in an English and art scroll, we're now in the double digits. So that's a huge accomplishment. There's 24 blot in the Masechta. We're on number 10 right now. So this is a big accomplishment. Now, if you're looking at the actual page of the Gemara, you will notice something unique that I don't think we've had until now. What is missing? What is seemingly missing on this page? Does anyone know? What looks a little bit out of place, or what's missing that we're used to seeing?
There's no Mishnayot, for example. It's all straight to Gemara.
Okay, so Henry points out we've had a lot of Mishnayos recently for many weeks straight. But also you'll notice that both sides are accompanied by Rashi. There's no Tosos on this.
No Tosos.
Which usually, and you know, because there's no Tosos, there's more room for Gemara. So again, I brought this up during our Mishnah class today that, when there's a lot of text, it looks scarier. But really, when there's more text, usually it means it's actually smoother and simpler. And since the Bali Tosos are primarily a halachic commentary, what we're about to look at is primarily, it's halachic, but it's going to be a lot of agada, a lot of hashkafa, general ideas, rather than nitty-gritty legalism that we've been dealing with until now. So don't worry, we'll get back to that soon for all of our lawyers among us. But tonight, we're actually going to learn some themes, and I actually have a good tie-in to Lag BaOmer as well. So let's jump right into it. We are, let's see, I'm trying to describe, maybe.
I hear voices in the background.
Yeah, someone has noise from the. All right, I'm just going to mute everyone. Let's see if I can do that. So I'm going to mute everyone, but give you the option to unmute as well. So when you have a question, you'll unmute. Oh, that's much better. Okay, great. Moving forward. So we are, ballpark, it looks like around 10 lines down from the top of the page. And it might be it might be 10 to the second power already in art scroll, I'm just guessing. So we're starting with the words, the Chevron. Okay, so we're still in the skinny lines, as they call them, the Chevron. So about 10 lines, maybe a little bit more action at 10 lines from the top. Here we go. The Chevron, Ir Mikladu. So remember, we're describing the cities of refuge. We're getting into the details, right? We've spent the past few weeks discussing who gets sent into exile, but we never really dedicated a significant amount of time exploring, okay, great. This guy, he killed inadvertently, he killed Bashogeg, he gets sent to exile. What exactly is exile? So we learn it's one of the cities of refuge where the Levium live. Okay, great, it's one of those cities, but give us a little bit more flavor. Tell us about those cities. So we started elaborating on the nature of those cities last time, and we're going to continue on that this time as well. The Chevron Ir Mikladu, but first we're asking, wait a minute, remember last time we learned that Chevron is one of the cities of refuge? But wait a minute. The cities of refuge are primarily given to the Levium, to the Levites. But it says in Sefer Yoshua, when they are divvying out the land of Israel, that Chevron, which we assume is a Levite city, a city of refuge, is actually given to Kalev. So how can it be given to Kalev if it belongs to Levium? So Amar Abaye, So they gave Kalev the suburbs of the city, right? So you can almost imagine, or imagine we're talking about Stanford over here. So the Levium got downtown Stanford, and then the Kalev people, they got, somewhere either like northern or they got North Stanford, basically. They got the suburbs near the city, or they got our area at the shul. I'm not sure exactly how to draw the line over there, but just to give you an idea. So that's how they split it up. Similar question also, the Kadesh Ir Miklat Havi. Also, remember we talked about Kadesh, which is up north in Israel. We said that's also a city of refuge. But wait a minute, Bachsiv, Va'are Mifsar, we were taught here, these are the Pasuk says these are the fortress cities. Now, if something's a fortress city, right? We're thinking of like Helm's Deep or Gondor. So really strong fortress-like cities. Jeremy, that was for you, yes. And anyone else who got that. So if we're talking about a fortress-like city, that doesn't qualify for Ari Miklat. And Ir Miklat, as we're about to learn, has to be more of a medium-sized place. So these are the fortress cities. Atzadin, Sar, V'chamas, Rekis, V'chineres, V'kadesh, V'edrei, V'in Chatzor. So you see Kadesh is listed as a massive fortress. One of the rules for an Ir Miklat is that it should be big enough that it can sustain a population very well without difficulty, but it shouldn't become too big. One of the reasons might be so a Goel Hadam, someone who's trying to assassinate the person who accidentally killed his relative, he can't slip in easily. So Rav Yosef, Tarti Kadesh Avi, there were two Kadeshes. One is the Ir Miklat, one was the fortress city. Aramashi, he could go in Slikum to Akra to Slikum. Just like there's a place called Slikum, and there's somewhere called Akra to Slikum, which I think is village of Slikum. So many times, you'll have rabbis in the Gemara with the same name. You'll have places with the same name. That's life. People share the same names all the time. Okay. End of that piece. Now, on that, Gufa, on that matter that we just discussed, so here's the important point. I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler. This is going to be the critical premise of everything we are about to study right now. There is an imperative that society has a responsibility. That when someone goes into galus, into exile, we have to give him everything. We have to provide everything that he would need to survive while in exile. And all the rules we're about to look at is about making sure that the person can be sustained in exile. Now, a question that comes up, I think, in American law and politics is when someone goes to jail, someone is incarcerated, we have to get, ethically, of course, we have to give them the essentials. But what exactly are the essentials? Also, when we give welfare to people who can't afford basic living standards, we have to give them the essentials. So there's always these debates about what constitutes the essentials. Okay, having food and beverage, that's an essential. Arguably now, having broadband, having internet access, people argue nowadays has become a necessity. I remember I was once sitting in a seminar, someone argued having culturally appropriate food is a necessity for people. So it ranges the gamut. People have all sorts of ideas of when you say, I need something, what do I need? So we're going to look at that right now. So the So the Ari Miklat, remember, there's not just six of them. There was an additional 42. The Ari Miklat, the cities of refuge, have to be built in a place that there is water. And there's no water, build a canal and make sure that water could be piped through to it. The Emoshim Osaba Makam Shvakim also, it has to be set up that there is a marketplace over there. It doesn't have to be Machane Yehuda per se, but it has to be, it has to have your bare essentials. It has to have a kosher aisle at the Stop and Shop. So then it's livable. The Emoshim Osaba Makam Ochlosin. Also, there should be surrounding, not necessarily cities, but surrounding villages. So that way, if the Goel Hadam, this is also a word I'm not going to translate a lot, so you can write it down if you want to remember. Goel Hadam, or in plural, Goel Hadam. That literally means the redeemers of the blood. Those are the family members that want to avenge the relative that was killed inadvertently. It's just such an awkward thing to translate, so we're just going to say it in Hebrew. Goel Hadam, Goel Hadam. That's in plural. So the redeemers of the blood. Good? Okay. That'll make things smoother. So in case the Goel Hadam will amass a militia and try to take over the city, we want to make sure that there are surrounding villages who can provide reinforcements so that they can't just, sack the city over there and take over the whole place. And so if we lose some of these surrounding villages, right? If these villages were more urban areas, it's COVID, I'm moving to the suburbs now, and now all of a sudden no one's living there anymore, so then we have to repopulate them. This if we run out of people living in the Ir Miklat, people want to move into suburban lifestyle, they're escaping the city. Likewise, Mevilim Kohan Levim Yisraelim, we make sure there are Kohan and Levim Yisraelim who are living there. So I guess we offer them some kind of, that's what's going on in New York City right now. Whoever's going to be next mayor needs to figure out how to bring people back into New York City. So apparently the Gemara figured out some sort of way to incentivize people to resettle Ari Miklat. Unfortunately, we're not told the secret to incentivizing people. Maybe they made them an offer they couldn't refuse. But whatever strategy they had, maybe if we knew what it was, it could be helpful. For us in Stanford, though, we're actually happy that that people are moving out. It's beneficial for us. Anyway, the Ein Mocher Behen Lo Kli Zayin Lo Kli Metsuda, and this is very interesting. We do not sell weaponry in the city, nor do we sell trapping devices in the city.
Gun control, strict gun control.
Right. Okay, good, exactly. So, but that's the Rabbi Nechemia, the minority opinion. Chacham and say we couldn't give up your gun rights, even in the Ir Miklat, we still allow for weapons to be sold here. So there's a very interesting discussion, as Harry points out, about gun control. You see, is this a more general machlokis about how weaponry should be sold? Or maybe the Ir Miklat is the exception that proves the rule. Because even Rabbi Nechemia, who's stringent when it comes to the Ir Miklat, he's extra careful about regulating weapon sales there because the Goel Hadam might slip in, buy weapons, and then kill the people who are there. But maybe in a regular city, it's not as much. So when I read the Gemara the first time, Henry, I was thinking that as well. Interesting discussion to be had from there. I couldn't find in the Chashuk Echemed. Apparently, he didn't deem it worthy enough to address. I think gun control is a bigger question in America than it is in Israel. So that's probably why. Okay. But however, they both agree, however, they agree, people shouldn't be actually assembling traps and ropes so that the Goel Hadam won't have an easy time killing and assassinating whoever they want to kill to avenge the blood of their fallen. One last line, and then we'll pause for questions. It says in the verse, he should flee to one of these cities and live there. Shkoyach, what, he's supposed to run to one of those cities and die there? What's it coming to teach me by saying v'chai, and he should live there? This is the important principle we mentioned before. Ovid le nidi tahavi le chiyusa. You have to provide for him so that he may live in there. Now, back to my question before. Okay, making sure that there's water, making sure that there's a marketplace, so you could buy kosher food, there's a kosher aisle. Okay, so that sounds like the bare minimum. But what we're about to see in the Gemara is that the essentials are not limited to just having a kosher aisle and Stop and Shop and in your local grade A, but actually there's a very startling line that we're about to read in the Gemara. But before we get to that, did anyone have any clarification questions that we could pause to address? Zadie, I think you're saying something, but you're muted. You know, okay. So Zadie, when you get Bobby, figure out how to unmute, I'll take the question. I'm just going to go a little bit forward in the meantime. Anyone else? Okay. All right. See, my grandmother figured out how to unmute. My grandfather's still learning, so they make a good tag team. He does the learning, she does the unmuting. So Tana, Tama Shagola, Megalan, Rabo, Emo. So here's a very startling line. A student, if someone is a yeshiva bacher, and, you know, have you seen what was happening in Panovich in Israel, by the way? In this yeshiva, Lipish yeshiva in Bnei Brak in Israel, there's two factions right now because I think there's a power vacuum. I haven't looked into all the politics. One rabbi died, it's a power vacuum. So now there's one side battling out the other, and they actually, like, they attacked the rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva of the other faction in the yeshiva. So, right, imagine, but that's more malicious. Imagine, you know, one guy, the yeshiva bacher, he's shuckling one day, and he, like, you know, he just, like, accidentally his saber slips out of his hand, hits the guy a few rows ahead of him, knocks him out cold, he's dead. So the yeshiva bacher needs to go into exile now. What can you provide for yeshiva bacher to make sure that he lives when he is in exile? Megalan Rabo Emo, his Rebbe, his teacher, needs to go into Gullis with him as well. Wow. Shenemar, and what's the rationale? Lechai, because he has to live when he's in exile. So you have to give him what to live with. It's not just enough to have food and water. Ain't my mela Torah, right? We say you have to provide water for him. Water is Torah. Torah is water. So yeah, his Rebbe has to go to Gullis with him as well.
I think I'm unmuted now.
Ah, it sounds like you're unmuted now. Yes.
Yes, Bubby helped me.
Okay.
My thought was that they would want to sell weapons in the city of refuge because the Goli Hadam are going to come with weapons. And why did we have the surrounding communities to reinforce the city? Because the city has weapons, but they may need more people to help defend the city.
So I remember I was watching when I was on a flight there were, like, to Israel, and there was, like, this really bad, I think it was that APAC trip I referenced. So I watched a zombie apocalypse movie, which is like every other movie these days. And so they created like this hippie city during the middle of the zombie apocalypse where they don't allow any weapons in. Sure enough, the zombies come. And meanwhile, all these people who are living in utopian society, they had no weapons to defend themselves against the zombies, were getting overrun easily. So your point's well taken. You know, if you don't have any weapons in the city, it might be peaceful. But once one person comes to conquer the city, you're left defenseless. So I think we have to assume there is a town guard in place, which would be the equivalent of police officers nowadays. But what they're saying is they don't want civilians willy-nilly selling and trading firearms and weaponry, because then all it takes for the Goli Adam is to walk in the city, doesn't need to go through any background checks or anything, just purchases a sword or a rifle, and then he can go on his merry way and kill whoever he wants. So,
and I think they're going to come with weapons. They don't need to purchase them in the city.
Oh, well, if they come in the city, they'll have to check their weapons at the gate. I mean, I imagine, like, you go for a pat down when you're at the airport. I imagine a town guard confiscates any weapons.
I can sneak into New York City.
Well, maybe weapons. New York City wasn't the best example. We're assuming there's some sort of borders or ways for them to regulate it. I mean, look, obviously, someone's crafty enough to get past the. They'll get past the NSA, but they do what they can. Okay, but going back to our topic right now. So we said a yeshiva bacher that goes into Gullis, his Rebbe goes with him. Amar Rebbe Zira, Mikan Sholi Shana Adam L'Tama Sheino Hagen. What do we learn from here? That a Rebbe should not teach students who are not worthy, because as we will learn soon in the Gemara, a person who kills inadvertently many of the times, it's because they have accumulated certain sins, and God causes events to be orchestrated in a way that they inadvertently kill someone so that they go to the city of refuge to atone for their sins. So a Rebbe should make sure to teach students who are not sinful. That way, he doesn't have to get sent into Gullis with them. So I think very highly of all of you. So don't bring me into Gullis at any point, please. okay, so any thoughts on that over there as a necessity, as an essential?
So I do have a thought. I think it's interesting that a couple things. One, it is an alternative to capital punishment for the right circumstance in the crime, and it it seems that there's a focus on following through with the promise. We're not sending you to your death. We're not sending you to some hellish prison where you get bread and water and it's violent all the time. It's, you can't be in normal society. We're going to send you to the city of refuge for your own protection to recognize that you did something wrong, but we're not going to take away your life from you. And so whether it's the study of Torah or the ability to have social interactions, to follow your faith, to, you know, shop for kosher food, whatever, all of those things, I think it's a humane way of exacting a punishment, but also rehabilitation.
So I like that point that you're making, Jeremy. You're saying that there's a kind of like a restorative element to the city of refuge. We're not stripping you of your humanity and throwing you in Rikers Island, but we're giving you some form, and this could only work, by the way, for someone who didn't kill maliciously. That's the whole idea. Someone who did kill maliciously, we can't just put you in another city and hope for the best. So we're talking about someone who was, culpable, but not maliciously, not for malicious reasons. So I do like the point that you're making about this middle ground about the Ir Mikla. Okay, so let's move forward. If you thought this statement was already puzzling and jarring, Amar Rav Yochanan, Harav Shagol Megali Shivaso Imo. Let's say the Rebbe inadvertently kills someone, then his whole entire yeshiva needs to relocate with him. So, right, imagine, you know, a Rosh Yeshiva of Beis Meresh Gevoah in Lakewood. So he gets sent into Golis or accidentally killing someone. So the entire Lakewood now needs to uproot and move to a city of refuge. Wouldn't that be crazy? Amy, wait a minute. Is this so? Because what's the point of going to a city of refuge? To give you refuge from the Goli Hadam. But wait, why should this Rosh Yeshiva, this great Torah scholar, need to go to near Mikla to protect himself? Bamar Rav Yochanan, Minayin L'Divrei Torah Shein Kolton. Shenemar Esbotzar Bamidbar. Sivasrei V'Zos HaTorah. We learn from the verses that when someone studies Torah, it protects themselves from danger. So if this rabbi is always learning Torah, right, even when he's doing very casual and menial tasks, you know, Torah is always on his mind. So then how is it possible? Why would he need to bother going to near Miklat if the Torah learning he's always thinking about will protect him? So we got two answers for that. Number one, Lo kasha habin into asik habin into lo asikba. Look, at some point, his mind's going to be thinking about something other than Torah. Even if, you know, he was Rav Eliashiv or Moshe Feinstein, eventually he's going to have to think about something that's not Torah related. And that's when the Gol Hadam can strike and successfully kill him. Answer number two, B-boy Seyma, my Colton, me Malcha Moves. It doesn't protect you from a human being, but it creates like a supernatural barrier that only protects you from the angel of death. And how do we know? What's a story that tells us that learning Torah protects you from being killed by the angel of death? So there's a similar story with King David, but we're going to see another version of the story with Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda was shuckling back and forth. He was learning Torah. Nothing could disturb him until since he was learning Torah, the angel of death was not able to prevail over him and to take his life. So what did the angel of death do if he can't take his life because he's learning Torah? Well, if he removes Torah from the equation, that's when he could successfully take his life. So Solik v'yosva arza de beirav, Haka arza v'shosik v'yachole. So he went on top of a cedar tree, he broke a branch, and that branch broke and made a huge noise for a second. Rechisa said, what was that? Comes in Machamavitz with his scythe, takes away his soul, and that's how he succeeded. But what we learn from the story is that when someone's studying Torah, it protects them from the Malchamavitz, from the angel of death. This is all to answer that if all it does is protect you from the angel of death, but not from human beings, from Goli Hadam, even a great Rosh Hashiva is learning Torah all day, he needs to go to the Ir Miklat as well to seek refuge and protection from the Goale Hadam. Okay, end of that section. I want to cover ground, so just clarification, anything unclear. These Gemaras are going to be rather straightforward, I think. Nothing too complicated in terms of new concepts. We have a few miscellaneous ideas now. Why, when we're listing the cities of refuge, Reuven gets mentioned first? It's Mina Kenegavida. He gets rewarded for what he did. Because he was the first one to come to the aid of Yosef, to Joseph, when he was in need. The other sons of Jacob wanted to kill Joseph, and Reuben was the first one to come to his aid. And therefore, he was acknowledged for doing that, and he got the first city of refuge under his territory. Darsha Simlai, next piece. That Moshe designated three cities in the Transjordan area. Either in present tense command or in past tense. But the idea is that when Moshe designated cities of refuge, God said, you have provided a light for the way of those who have inadvertently killed, then now they have a city of refuge to protect them from the Goale Hadam. Great.
It's answering the question, why does the Pasuk have to mention Mizrach HaShemesh?
Right, particularly the Shemesh. What's the sun have to do with anything here?
Well, why do they mention it there? Okay.
So the idea is that Moshe shined a light and gave, so basically everything we mentioned earlier, I think Rashi mentions this. Yes. Look in Rashi, Hazrei Shemesh L'Rotzkin, L'Hachin Lehem Chiyusam, to provide life necessities. In other words, everything that we mentioned the Gemara until now, Moshe Rabbeinu made sure that was in place. And that's what the verse means when it says he shined the light onto them. He gave them a glimmer. Like you think of it as he gave them a glimmer of hope that their life isn't all over. They'll be able to survive and prosper to a certain extent, even while they are in Galus, in their exile. Great. Now we're going to have a number of drushos. The first thing we're going to have one verse that, and we're going to expound a lot on this verse. I think it's from Kohelis, from Ecclesiastes or Mishlei. Let me check.
So we'll Kohelis.
Kohelis. My Kohelis. First one. Okay. So it's from Kohelis, and it's going to start with a derivation that has to do with Ari Miklat, but then it's going to become about Torah study, which of course is always relevant, but especially relevant with the holiday of Shavuos coming up. So very timely. Darash Rasimai, my v'chsiv, oev kesef lo yispa kesef, umi ohe bahamon lo tfua. So the literal translation is someone who loves money, he'll never be satiated, he'll never be sated with money. Umi ohe bahamon, he who loves the multitudes, he will not have grain, he will not have the sustenance that he needs. Now the word lo, spelled lamed alev, means he does not have tvua, he doesn't have sustenance, but the way the rabbis are going to play with this verse is that they're going to read it like it's lamed vav. Someone who loves the multitudes, he will have much tvua, much sustenance. And we're going to see a few iterations of how the rabbis played around with the pasuk here. I mean, play around in a positive way, not in a negative. Oyv kesef lo yisba kesef. Zem Moshe Rabbeinu sheyodiyashin shalosh arm shemir yarding koltos ashal nivcharu shalosh shem eretz Kanaan ba'amar mitzvah shebaliyadi akai mena. So this the first part of the verse refers to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was the one who loved kesef. Kesef here actually refers to silver, something that is dear to us. What's dear to us? Fulfilling the words of God. Okay, and so Moshe Rabbeinu said, I know I'm not going to be able to enter into the land of Israel, but I'm going to at least establish the first three cities of refuge, even though we learned that the first three cities are not operative until the other three cities, until the three cities in Israel are established. But still, Moshe Rabbeinu said, if I have the opportunity to begin to start this mitzvah, how can I squander the opportunity? So he was the one who was oev kesev l'yisba kesev. He was never satisfied. He was always trying to perform more mitzvos. Now, the latter part of the pasuk is what we're going to focus on a lot. Umi oev amon lo tvua. What does it mean? He who loves the multitudes, lo tvua. Lami na lelami behamon, mishachol tvua shalom. So I'm in a group of we were students in Reitz together in Smicha. So we had a chabur with Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, Rabbi J.J. Schachter. And it was free pizza, good armchair discussions about the state of modern Orthodoxy. It was a lot of fun. So we still have a WhatsApp group going. And we had a whole debate 1 or 2 days ago. We're debating who gets to paskin halacha, who gets to make halachic decisions. And at what point does a typical pulpit rabbi have to turn to a senior authority like Rav Herschel Schachter, Rabbi Mordechai Willick? So Rav Herschel Schachter, and I think many people actually have this belief, it's not his uniquely, asserts that if someone wants to paskin halacha, they actually need to know all areas of halacha. And Toby, you perked up, you heard Rav Herschel Schachter, right? So you have to know all areas of you have to know all areas of halacha in order to paskin even a single area. This was the, and I don't want to get too much into the politics of it, this is the controversy with Yoatzot Halacha, that if they're only going to study the laws of Nidav and not other areas, they won't know how the broader scheme of Halacha operates. You can make a similar claim for people like me who only get Yor Smicha and don't study necessarily Choshe Mishpah, monetary law. But the idea here, we see in the Gemara, is who should be teaching in the crowd? Who should be teaching publicly, Torah publicly? Misha Kol Tvusha, someone who actually has all the tefuah, who has all the Torah, someone who is a master of all areas or has a familiarity at least with all areas. So who should tell the praises of God, sing the praises of God publicly? Who should be praising God publicly? Someone who's able to be mashmia, to teach all the different areas of God's Torah, that informs you because you think, I learned the laws of charity and tzedakah, be'ian, I'm an expert in it. But if I never learned any other areas of monetary law, or even other areas of halacha, learn how the basic ideas of chazaka and spekos work, then even though I think I might be an expert in hilchos tzedakah, chances are I'm going to be lacking in something because I don't understand the broader scheme of how halacha operates. So that's an important point over here. Derivation number two. Rabbana Vitim Rabbi Barmari Amar, Mio Bahaman Lotfua, Kola Oev Lamalami Bahama, so Kola Oev, skip the mind actually, Kola Oev Bahaman Lotfua. He who loves people who have a multitude, meaning Rashi understands it as he who loves those who are Talmidei Chachamim, who have a multitude of Torah knowledge, he will be blessed with sustenance, meaning he will have children who will study Torah and follow in the ways of God. So the rabbis, they look very closely at Rava, the son of Rava, who was someone who loved Torah scholars, and as a result had children who also became scholars and followed in the ways of God. Okay. Number three, third interpretation of this verse. Simon Ashi Lilo Rabino Lami. Rav Ashi Amar Kol Ohev Lilmo Behamon Lo Tvua. He who loves to teach the masses will find it very rewarding. Now, this is important. It doesn't mean someone who loves to teach the masses so he can become a cult leader and become glorified, but we're about to learn he loves to teach in the masses because he learns. But the more people he teaches, the more he learns from the people that he teaches. So we'll get to it actually in a moment. It says that there is a sword on the individuals and they become dumbfounded. Okay, so Torah scholars, by the way, I was preparing this Gemara on my own, so I may have just violated it. So, I'm not a Torah scholar, so I guess I didn't violate it. But someone who learns Torah on their own, it says that there is a sword right over their neck, ready to decapitate them as punishment. And not only that, but they become they lose intelligence by learning on their own. Right? We say in Slichos all the time, Asher na'anu, Asher chatanu. So we learn, not only do they become dumbfounded, blow od, el shechotin, but they're sinning when they learn on their own without another individual. Shenemar, Asher chatanu, because it says also, Asher chatanu, we have sinned as well. Now, what's so terrible about learning on your own? You know, I was praying this Gemara class. I don't have a chavrusa middle of the day. I actually find I learn better when I'm learning on my own. So what's so terrible about learning on one's own? So I'll share with you something related, actually, to Lag BaOmer. So, all right, we're going to bring out my good friend, this big Nitzotze Ashas over here, which has all my favorite Hasidish Taira, which I know Henry's a big fan of, right? All of our favorite Hasidish of arts over here. I saw a smile. So he brings in, of course, a few fun Hasidic interpretations. And he asks the question, what's so bad about learning on one's own? In fact, last week we learned in Pirkei Avos in chapter 3 that it says, Shnaim sheyoshvim ish b'nim divrei Torah, shchina shru b'nim, two people that are learning Torah together, the divine presence rests with them. And then the Mishnah says, even one person who's studying Torah on their own, the divine presence still rests with them. So really, when I'm studying Torah, I'm actually never alone because God is always with me when I'm studying Torah. So if so, how am I violating this this idea over here? Why am I not allowed to learn Torah on my own if Hashem is always with me? So he says, we know the Gemara Maseches Sota in other places says that someone who is arrogant, arrogance is a midah that God is very averse to. And if someone is arrogant, God basically says, apparently there's not enough room for me and your ego. So God doesn't like spending time with those who are very full of themselves. So if someone is learning by themselves, someone who only learns on by themselves, it doesn't mean you have to prepare a shiur and you have to, prepare it on your own. What it means is people who deliberately only want to hear their own opinion. Some people, you go on social media, you see a lot of this, they're convinced that their opinion is the only opinion and their way is the right way. And if you disagree with them, they have a whole list of adjectives to brand you with for disagreeing with them. And we won't go into that here. But if someone, what's it mean that they learn by themselves? It means they only have room for their own perspective, their own opinion. Then, A, you lose intelligence. That's unintelligent because you're not hearing counter arguments. You're not able to think through things more critically. And number two, it could lead to sin as well. And that actually, he says, was the sin. He says that was the sin of the students of Rabbi Akiva, right? So right now, we're at Lag BaOmer now. We're celebrating Rabbi Akiva's students historically finally stopped dying from a plague. But why were they dying to begin with? Why did God bring upon this terrible calamity among the students of Rabbi Akiva? The reason is, it says in the Gemara Yevamos, they didn't give kavod to each other. So when, if you went to Jewish day school and your Mora Rebbe was teaching it to you, likely they said, Rabbi Akiva's students were not nice to each other. And because you have to have midos and not just learn Torah, but have midos, therefore they died. By the way, historically, they were probably part of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And they died in the Bar Kokhba revolt. That may have actually been what happened from a historical perspective. But anyway, the idea that he gives over here, quoting from the Biurei Chasidus Lashas, which must be another good week and safer, is that once Rabbi Akiva's students realized, what was the issue? That they weren't noe kavod zelazah, they couldn't care less to hear the other guy's opinion. They were so fooled themselves, they had so much arrogance that they, even though if they were learning with their chavrusa, they didn't really care what their chavrusa had to say. They thought that their way was superior. And it was only once Rabbi Akiva's students realized, you know what, maybe I have what to learn from somebody else. Maybe my preconceived notions are wrong and I should hear what someone else has to say and value a diversity of intelligent opinions, then that's when this calamity stopped and they were nohei kavod ze lezeh. It's not that, you know, they were calling each other names and putting thumbtacks on each other's chairs, like I learned in elementary school, but rather there was something deeper and something that, you know, even adults sometimes, we sometimes struggle with. So a very important lesson over there. And of course, relevant to Lag BaOmer tonight as well. So there's your connection right there. I did not plan. I actually just saw that and connected to Lag BaOmer. He did it for us. Hashgacha Pratis.
Okay. Masha?
Yes, Sadie.
I got called out of the room for something, so I missed part of what you said.
Bobby's taking precedence over me. It's okay.
Okay. But while you were discussing about learning on your own, what I thought I read a footnote on in preparing for tonight is that if you learn on your own, you can get a wrong idea and you build on it. And so the virtue of learning with one or more other people is that there's an exchange of ideas back and forth, different opinions. And so you're more likely to reach the truth with an exchange of ideas.
Absolutely. And you know what they say, by the way? They say that nowadays it's not possible to violate this prohibition. It's not possible to fall into this category because if you're learning with a masifta or an art scroll, that's like your chavrusa nowadays. Back then, they didn't have an art scroll to tell them when they were reading the Gemara wrong. So, so you see, so we all have our built-in chavrusas with the, everyone's showing their books over here. So, right, if all you were learning was with this Oz V'Hadar Gemara over here, you didn't have an art scroll masifta with you, you could be led astray. But nowadays, there's actually a, it's like an off-brand Masifta Gemara, like a Hebrew art scroll sort of, called a Chavrusa Gemara. They're not so popular because they have less than the Masifta, so why would you buy that? I call it the poor man's Masifta. That's what my friend called it. So it's called, actually, a Chavrusa, because if you don't have a Chavrusa, you got that safer right over there. It gives you everything you need. All right, we are at 9:14. Let's get this in before 9:30. Let's go forward. And we're almost at the end, by the way. So, the Ebais, one last little tidbit over there. The Ebais, Ema Mehacha, Noalu, sorry, and so on. How do we know that Noalu refers to becoming dumbfounded? It derives it from a different verse where it says the officers of so on became dumbfounded. All right. One last interpretation of that verse from Koheles, from Ecclesiastes. Rabina Amar, Koa Ovilame Bahamon Lotfua. Sorry. So, before I misread it. For it was he who loves to learn in the multitudes. Right, so Lil Mode, right? Adora actually gave me a heads up that I ignored. The first one was Lil Mode. He who loves to learn in the multitude is rewarded. Now we're saying he who loves to teach in the multitude is rewarded. And what's it mean, he who loves to teach is rewarded? Again, not for, it's a very tough thing in my line of work. You know, rabbis are very prone to becoming fool themselves and loving the big crowds. But it's saying over here, it's not that you should love all the attention and adoring fans and criticisms that you get when you get to speak in the big crowds, but rather, this is a very famous line over here, so many of you, I think, will recognize this. I have learned much Torah from my teachers. I learn even more Torah from my colleagues. But from my students, I learned more than my teachers and colleagues all together. And the importance of teaching larger crowds is that when we learn together as a chabura, everyone here is able to share questions, different haros and ideas that each of us, if we were only studying with a gemara on our own, we would never have reached. So those are the benefits of learning together in large crowds, is that we all get to share our different perspectives and insights together, and we come out with a more enriched perspective when we are studying Torah.
I remember hearing a story or reading it. There was a prominent rabbi who was teaching his shiur, and he had prepared a whole long lesson. And near the beginning of it, somebody asked a question that challenged him. He closed his book. He said, "You're right. I'm finished."
So there is a story. I mean, it's one of those kind of stories that, you know, it's like a Mad Libs, insert your favorite Gadol, and it's about him. I heard about Rav Soloveitchik, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, insert whichever gullible you want. I'm sure it's happened a few times. But yeah, there are stories like that. And it shows a certain level of intellectual honesty and integrity that you're willing to admit, yeah, wow, I really botched this one up. Okay, let's get to the end. All right, Shimon Levi, Midas Siv, another good one. Om dos hayrag lehem bisharet Yerushalayim, that we're standing in the gates of Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. What do we learn from this verse? Mi goram l'rag lehem shiyamdu b'melchama? What gives us the fortitude to stand in the ranks of battle to defend the Jewish people? Shara Yerushalayim, the gates of Yerushalayim, Shayu Oiskim Batayra, who are sitting and learning Torah, that's what gives us the strength to be in the front lines. So, and that really is the Hester Yeshiva mentality. This is what we learned is actually, I think it was a Medrash, that when the Jews in the Midbar, in the wilderness, went out to battle, some of the people were learning and praying, while some of them were going out to battle. So it was like for our fantasy fans, like a battle meditation, giving them some sort of aura of power to succeed in battle. So the idea is, you see in our Rav Lifshitz shiur, we have this debate all the time about the state of Israel we were talking about. So obviously in some places they think you only learn Torah, you don't go to the army, but this actually supports both, which is some need to go out to battle, some need to be learning Torah at the same time. Maybe both, they take turns. But there's a need for both. There's a need for the century we were talking about before. We need the religion and the Zionism, but not just separately, but it's supposed to be religious Zionism going together. So this is an excellent passage in the Gemara, which combines both ideas.
I might add that war is one of the mitzvot.
Right.
And,
well, it depends what kind of war we're talking about, actually. There's a Melchemes Mitzvah, the conquered land of Israel, but also when we conquered Syria, the Syrian area, there are voluntary wars, Melchemes Rishus. But we'll say that for another year, hopefully. Let's just get to the end. I think it's a popular, maybe Yeshua voice choir song. I don't remember. Toby, you know the Five Town song, so you can let us know if you hear it next time you go. You're our expert. So I think it's going like Samachti. Okay. Someone will have to fill me in on this one. But it's that there's a psalm that's attributed to David HaMelech. Okay, because not all Tehillim was necessarily written by David HaMelech, but this one is attributed to him. He says, I rejoice when they say, let's walk to the house of God. Amar David the B'nai HaKadosh Baruch, the Ribbono Shel Olam. David says to God, now anyone else would be lamenting, but David HaMelech, King David, was celebrating. Shemati B'nai Adam Sheyu Aymrim, Masai Yomuzakin Zeh. When is this old man going to die? When is King David going to die already? He heard people saying. So that his son Solomon, King Shlomo, can build the temple finally. And we can go up and celebrate the three holidays before God. I heard all this, and anybody else would be distraught. They're praying for me to die. Oh, I'm down in the dumps. But me, David Hamel says, V'samachti, I rejoiced because they so badly wanted to serve Hashem. But God realized, somewhere in David's psyche, there was some element of dismay. You hear people say, when's this old man going to die? And you're that old man they're talking about. It's a little bit hard to be 100% besimcha about that, to be in joy about it. So Hashem, right. So Hashem gives him consolation. God says to him, for one day in your courtyard is greater than 1,000. What's that mean? Greater is to me is just one day of you learning Torah. May Elef Oile Shahas Shlomo bin Chulahakr May Al-Lefanai Al-Gabe Mizbeach. Then the thousands of sacrifices that your son is going to bring in the temple. Just one day of you learning Torah is greater to me than 1,000 sacrifices that your son is going to bring. That's how much Hashem valued the Torah that David HaMelech was studying. And so, of course, we pray to have a temple rebuilt again because we want Torah and we want to bring offerings to Hashem in his temple. But never underestimate the power and the value of studying Hashem's Torah. And he says, one day of you studying Torah is greater than 1,000 sacrifices that Solomon is going to bring. That's how much Hashem values our Torah study. Okay, end of all of the, I guess what we call the fun pieces, the Saturday morning sermon material pieces. Now we're just going to, so we get on to the next Amud, two little technical pieces right over here, and then we will conclude. Remember, so we're quoting from the Mishnah now. The Mishnah said that we should prepare pathways so that people know how to get from where they are to the Ari Miklat. So if you're in Jerusalem, right, there should be a sign that says Tel Aviv that way, and then also Ir Miklat that way. Tanya, we learned in the Braisa, Rabbi Lezer and Yaakov Omer, turning the page. We are now on 10b, Yivna Beis, Yashar Koach. Miklat Hayakasav, Al Parshas Derachim. That when there is an intersection on the path, there has to be a sign at every intersection to get you there. Because, you know, I'm a young guy, so by the time I was driving, there was already some form of GPS available. So I was never truly lost because I always had some form of GPS. But, you know, if my GPS was ever out, I had to use, you know, I'm going on like the Van Wyck or on the, you know, I'm heading into the city and I need to figure out what exit do I get to Washington Heights. I'll probably wind up in New Jersey. That's what happened to my father. I remember they wanted to go to a concert at YU in Washington Heights. And everyone knows when you take the Harlem River Drive up, if you don't know where you're going, you are going to wind up in New Jersey. You're just going to wind up on the George Washington Bridge. So I don't know how they navigated things back then. Before GPSs, you could all tell me. You all had to live that life. But so they had signs. They had signs that were up. Also, so people knew how to get to the Ari Miklat because they didn't have a GPS back then. One last thing. Why is it saying the verse, prepare for yourself the way? Very simply, you should make proper preparations to make sure that you make it to the Ir Miklat safely and securely. And with that, we will conclude our Gemara learning for tonight. I hope you enjoy the little bit of the lighter Gemara. Not as technical, but really excellent ideas that are important to internalize, and also a good connection to Lag BaOmer. So everyone enjoy Lag BaOmer and have a wonderful Shabbos. Looking forward to seeing those who will be with us in person and those who aren't. God willing, I'll catch you on the Zoom next week. But if it entices you at all, we're upgrading our Kiddush to Shabbos, right, Toby? What do we got? What do we have that's extra? Tell us.
I think that's the song.
Tuna fish, egg salad, Israeli salad, hummus, and fruit salads.
There we
Plus all kinds of Drake's cakes, and depending on which menu you go to, there might be a little bit more mashka, a little bit less mashka.
Sounds like a feast. A feast rather than kiddush.
What?
It sounds like a feast.
No, they're going to be little, like individual portions, but it should be very nice. It should be very nice.
Good Shabbos, everybody.
All right, good Shabbos, everyone.
Thank you all.
Shabbos. Thank you.